Support comes from Gemma, architects, planners, and designers seeking to bring joy to their clients and communities. Details at gemastl.com.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. One of the few places where Missouri Republicans have failed in the last couple of decades to make an impact is successfully combating initiative petitions they don't like. Despite the GOP's efforts, Missouri voters have protected abortion rights, expanded Medicaid, raised the minimum wage, and legalized marijuana. This year, though, Missouri Republicans pursued a familiar strategy, using their strength in the General Assembly to overturn or try to overturn voter-approved ballot items. During the last week of session, Missouri Republicans repealed part of Proposition A that required businesses to provide paid sick leave to workers. They also placed a measure on the 2026 ballot to overturn much of Amendment 3, which protected abortion rights. And earlier in the year, legislators carved up a 2012 ballot item that effectively gave the St. Louis mayor's office control of the police department. This strategy mirrors what the GOP-controlled legislature did in the recent past. They've overridden voters on conceal and carry regulations, dog breeding restrictions, and an overhaul of state legislative redistricting known as Clean Missouri. And Democrats like State Representative Ian Mackey of Clayton say his Republican colleagues won't stop doing this sort of thing because they don't face electoral consequences.
You know, there were people on my street that had yard signs up that said, yes on three, vote for Mike Kehoe for governor. Did that make sense to me? Absolutely not. But as long as folks can have their cake and eat it too, I think this is the state we're in, and we're in this doom loop where we continue to have proposition after proposition. People get rich off them, they put them on the ballot, they make money off them, the consultants go away happy, and then we just keep this loop going.
So is Mackey correct here, or could 2026 be the year where Republicans face real electoral pain for going after voter-approved initiatives? Joining us first to talk about this topic is Republican political consultant David Barklage. Barklage was instrumental in helping Missouri Republicans capture the state Senate in the early 2000s and also worked on a number of successful ballot initiatives over the years. David, welcome to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
I appreciate the opportunity, Jason. Anytime to be interviewed by you is an honor and a pleasure.
And it is an honor and a pleasure to speak directly with the Prince of Darkness himself, David Barklage. David, this year was not the first time Missouri Republicans in particular went after voter-approved ballot initiatives. In your experience, why do you think the GOP-controlled legislature has continued to do this for 20 years or more?
Because they're oversensitive and they're not seeing the big picture. And I can make that critique based on the construct of legislation that they have proposed. And the construct of such legislation, in the most part, is nothing more but a subterfuge to end IP as a tool, in fact, a tool of last resort, for citizens, which has been used for over 100 years to take on the Pendergast machine, to get substantive ethics, substantive spending reforms. All those things were done by the people. And I'll just point out something, Jason, that you know more than anything. Any student of history or of government would note the fact that the legislature is set up with checks and balances to protect the people's rights. To that regard, having both bodies and a governor have to sign off on something through a fairly extreme process means that you're not going to have radical thinking. And that was the reason we set it up. We did not want a legislature that on a whim would be radicalized and move the country or move the state dramatically in one direction or another. But as a result, it also has put an impediment to ever having reforms. And you have, I would challenge you in the last 20, even 40 years to look at what major reforms the legislature has done in terms of looking at themselves for governance. And then the last element I'll say is that special interest lobbying community has gotten more and more powerful, and their strength is not outside the building, inside the building, which means a further hindrance to real reform because real reform comes at the cost of some permanent interest.
It doesn't seem Republicans have faced many electoral consequences for this type of legislative behavior. They've gone from having small majorities in the Missouri House and Senate in the 2000s to supermajorities, and now they have all the statewide offices. Why do you think there hasn't been more blowback for this type of legislative behavior over the years?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is I don't think anybody has particularly highlighted that in an effective way. We see trends and historic trends that repeat themselves that sometimes are disrupted because of the incompetence or the competence of one party or the other. They sometimes change those things. But in this case, I haven't seen any group that's actually called them out on it. That's one. Two, I think there is some blame to go around, but I think the legislature is responding poorly. And that is, for example, on Medicaid, it was an unfunded mandate from a standpoint is it didn't have a revenue source tied to expansion. I'm sorry. And like transportation and most things that have, if you want better roads, we're asking you to raise this tax. I think that that is something that was unfortunate that can be corrected constitutionally to close unfunded mandate loophole. And to the extent that Republicans had some opposition to it, I think people understood it. Same thing on Clean Missouri, or even on the abortion amendment, the people crafting them got so cute in adding other provisions that were not really spoken about in the fair ballot language. The fair ballot language, as you know, is the 100 words that describe what you're actually voting on, which might be, as in case of weed or marijuana, 40 pages. Describe something 40 pages long in 100 words, you're going to leave something out. And in some cases, some of these ballot initiatives were very deceptive. I think there were some threads of legitimate pushback that the legislature could do. And I think to that case, as long as they're prosecuting those issues, they have some cover. But at some point, it will become an issue.
Well, you kind of touched on my next question. What I hear from Republicans all the time when they pursue legislative remedies to initiative petitions that passed is they say, the proponents ran misleading campaigns or, we were vastly outspent by the proponents. Is there any tangible proof, though, that voters actually made decisions because they were fooled by campaigns? Are legislators basically trying to read the collective minds of 1.5 million people that end up voting yes on a proposition?
Well, I think the answer is twofold. One, I think legislators justify in their minds whatever they want to come out to the reality of how they want to address an issue. And so I think that unfortunately, they're making a leap of faith in some cases to say, voters would have never gone for this. I do think, on the other hand, that polling that we have conducted on ballot language is juxtaposed a significant way between what is actually in it. So, for example, Clean Missouri is about these good things, contribution limits, et cetera, but it also creates all kinds of changes to redistricting and does A, B, and C. Well, I can tell you that all of a sudden the polling goes from 58% down to 40%. People not realizing that the Medicaid expansion didn't have really a revenue source that would have to come potentially at education cuts or other things if the budget came down. I would argue that if you test those arguments and language that described those things in it, we have shown empirical data that it drops below 50%. So I do think if you look at the polling can give you a pattern that language is written to capture voters' support, but it is not particularly fair nor accurate. And to that regard, again, I think it calls to question a certain fix. And to me, that is to create in the Constitution ballot language that is more accurate and more reflective of what is in the amendment and address hidden or misleading language so that the courts can do a preemptive case against a initiative on those bases. If you believe that there is misleading or inaccurate data that is not disclosed in the fair ballot language, I think that should be addressed.
Earlier this summer, I asked my Facebook followers what they would like to see changed about the Missouri Constitution. And a listener named Val Schweikart wrote, "Citizen initiatives passed by voters could not be modified or repealed by the legislature. It's like we're not smart enough to know what we want. It's got to stop." And there is an initiative floating around that would do just that, the Respect Mo Voters initiative. We'll talk about some of the details about that in a second. But do you think that the recent actions of the legislature could make this type of proposal more appealing to voters next year?
Absolutely. And look, I personally support a prohibition, whether it's 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. I think a reasonable amount of time. The legislature's job is to enact laws, and so I support them continuing to do it. It's not something that we should allow special interests to control. But with that being said, I think there should be a reasonable that if the voters speak, it shouldn't be in perpetuity because, you know, I think it was Jefferson said his Constitution is like a child's clothes, that as it grows into a man, it must change just as such the Constitution. But, and I'm sorry, I just probably chopped that up. But my point is that I think, a 3 to 5 year, something reasonable like that, or 5 to 7, you could argue anything, makes sense. Now, I would put an exception in there, that if there is a defect, because again, not everybody hires Chuck Hatfield or Mark Ellinger to write their constitutional language, and some people can put something on a statutes or in a constitutional amendment that is just destructive.
Yeah, and I think that this initiative in particular would say that the legislature could put something on the ballot if 80% of legislators would vote to put it on the ballot. But that's a really high bar, and I'm not really sure if even if there's a defect, you can get to 80% unless it's like, they said the sky was red instead of blue or something like that. But
yeah,
continue.
Because look, I think you can define it legally, what a defect is, and I think it should be well thought so that it's not unfair. But I do believe that if voters understood that an initiative petition could be written by a lawyer who's an idiot, by an interest that has deceptive or ulterior motives, that you would want the legislature to be able to address that. What you wouldn't want them to do is to just overturn the will of the people, at any time. And so I do think, let me give you, Jason, like, four or five challenges changes that everybody should think about. I think everybody should support an unfunded mandate clause. Medicaid expansion, whether you agree or disagree with it, the problem is that you want voters to understand the cost and understand that it probably needs a revenue source. Otherwise, you may be defunding other things you care about more. And I think that's something reasonable. It's done on roads, it's done on parks, it's done on everything else, but they didn't do it on Medicaid expansion, good or bad. I think restricting the content and scope of a constitutional amendment so you don't have a 40-page marijuana. I think you can write language that really keeps you from adjudicating or from creating, statute and operational language and keep it much more broad, much more narrow so that a constitutional amendment is a page or less, that it's hitting a very specific thing that's very easy to explain, because you can't explain 40 pages, and that's not appropriate in the Constitution. Next, I think that we got rid of a preemptive challenge. The courts no longer look at a preemptive challenge on the constitutionality of any amendment. And then after it's done and voted for by the people, they don't want to challenge it. So I think allowing a preemptive challenge to allow the constitutional lawyers to have that discussion with a court under the Missouri Court Plan makes sense to me. I also think more accurate ballot language and allowing the courts to address hidden language, unintended language, language that is misleading makes a lot of sense. And last, I do think that there ought to be a statutory prohibition of the legislature modifying those that have been passed by an IP for a certain amount of time unless there's a defect. If you do each of those, I would argue that addresses the Republican concerns on issues they disagree with.
But the Missouri Freedom Caucus has requested Governor Mike Kehoe call a special session in roughly a month to consider what's known as IP reform. That's very different from what you just talked about. It would probably be more along the lines of raising the threshold that you need to pass a constitutional amendment from a simple majority to, I don't know, 60% or 5 of 8 congressional districts. From what you just told me, it seems like you think legislators are barking up the wrong tree. Is that fair?
Absolutely. No, it's not fair. It's absolutely fair. And to that regard, look, I have probably been involved with and passed more initiatives than probably anybody else in politics. And to that regard, including two that were two of the three highest passed percentages at any time. And that's, I'm not doing that to pat myself on the back. What I'm doing to tell you is I have immense experience and I have watched the cost go from $1 million to getting something on the ballot. It's 3, 4, 5 million and they not even get it. Jason, you might not realize that less than 2% of petitions filed actually ever get to a vote and pass. And so with a 1% or a 2% success rate, I don't think, and a cost of $4 or $5 million, do we really? Is it good policy to try to make it even harder without addressing the fundamental problems that actually do exist? I think that is deceptive. I think it is partisan. I think it is short-sighted. Now, I support the governor. If the governor supports this, I'll probably be quiet because I think Mike Kehoe is doing a wonderful job, but I'll be sad if that happens because I think it's very short-sighted.
David Barklage is a Missouri Republican political consultant based in St. Louis County. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Enjoyed it, Jason. Please keep up the great work.
When we return, we'll talk with STLPR's Sarah Kellogg about how organizers plan to strike back against the legislature for repealing a voter-approved paid sick leave initiative. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. Welcome back to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. During the last segment, I alluded to how Missouri Republicans repealed portions of Proposition A, which raised the state's minimum wage to $15 an hour and instituted paid sick leave for workers. Shortly after lawmakers struck out the paid sick leave requirements, I asked Richard Von Glahn of Jobs with Justice an obvious question. What would stop people from circulating a constitutional amendment that lawmakers couldn't directly repeal that mandated paid sick leave for employees?
Nothing.
Von Glahn noted that Proposition A had widespread appeal, passing with more than 57% of the vote. It stands to reason that a similar proposal wouldn't have trouble passing next year if backers get the necessary signatures.
What we know is that the people of the state and the voters of the state supported what Proposition A is and support economic dignity for themselves and their neighbors.
St. Louis Public Radio's Sarah Kellogg has been exploring what's next for Proposition A proponents, and she joins us from Mid-Missouri to explain more. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Jason. As always, it's good to be back.
Before we get to how Proposition A supporters plan to strike back, can you just explain the different components of this initiative that passed with nearly 58% of the vote?
Yeah, so in the simplest terms, there were three main components of Proposition A. It raises the minimum wage in 2025 to $13.75 an hour, and then it raises it again to $15 an hour in 2026. And I want to clarify that that portion is still in effect, and it won't be affected when the new law goes into place. And so right now, the minimum wage will be $15 an hour in 2026. The second thing Prop A did was it tied the minimum wage in Missouri to the Consumer Price Index beginning in 2027, so that would have led to to future raises in minimum wage. That portion was eliminated through the legislature. And then finally, it requires employers to pay for 1 hour of paid sick leave for every 30 hours worked. And that was the other portion that was repealed by lawmakers. It's in effect now, but it will go away once the law goes into effect on August 28th.
Why did lawmakers want to repeal the paid sick leave portions of Proposition A?
The main argument I've heard from those who supported repealing that portion was that this placed too great of a strain on businesses in Missouri, that some had contacted their lawmakers and said this was going to require them to close or to downsize or to leave Missouri. And another argument against the sick leave portion was that it's a blanket approach to a nuanced issue. So some businesses can, you know, can handle it no problem, but others might have part-time or seasonal workers. So it didn't leave room for customization. And I think the position of a lot of like business back lawmakers, I know the Chamber of Commerce, was they just didn't like that it was a blanket mandate on something where they wanted more flexibility.
What was notable here is that House Speaker John Patterson said at the beginning of the year he was not in favor of delaying the implementation of the paid sick leave requirement in Proposition A, and yet he helped engineer the complete repeal of that component of this initiative. What gives here?
Yeah, he definitely changed his mind. This was Patterson's position before session started, but, you know, Speaker Patterson has brought up bills and issues before that he may not be in agreement with himself personally, but if it's something that his caucus wants, you know, he'll go through with it. An example would be the proposed constitutional amendment that would reban most abortions in the state. He didn't vote for that, but it was on the ballot. Now, he did call Proposition A, you know, a business killer, at least the sick leave portion, and he saw that keeping the minimum wage portion while getting rid of the sick leave as kind of a compromise position between what voters voted for and what Republicans wanted.
So let's look to the future. How confident are Proposition A supporters about putting a constitutional amendment before voters in 2026, locking in the paid sick leave requirements?
You know, that's a good question. I'm sure we'll get into the specifics in a minute. But overall, it is tougher to get a proposed constitutional amendment on the ballot instead of a statute change. So I think the biggest hurdle will be getting the signatures necessary to get it on the ballot. You know, Richard Von Glahn with Missouri Jobs of Justice, I've spoken with him and he said that, you know, if it makes it on the ballot, Missouri voters will vote for it. He's pretty confident in that. He also said that's not their only option. He said knowing that they have the support of Missourians gives them avenues, maybe either through legislation or other ways.
Can you explain how getting a constitutional amendment on the ballot is different from getting a statutory law on the ballot, which is what Proposition A was in 2024?
Yes. So the difference is in the signatures needed to be collected for something to go on the ballot in the first place. So for a statute change, you need signatures of 5% of voters in 6 of 8 of Missouri's congressional districts, which is roughly 106,000 signatures. Whereas a constitutional amendment, you need signatures from 8% of voters from 6 of the 8 districts. So that's roughly 170,000 signatures. So that's a lot more signatures. So that's the biggest hurdle. But once it's on the ballot, it's pretty much the same where it just requires a simple majority to pass.
Lawmakers got rid of paid sick leave provisions after they had gone into effect. So that means that employees have been accruing this sick leave that will go away later this month. What are employers and businesses going to do about this from what you've heard so far?
From who I've talked to, it really varies on the business. You know, I've heard options of maybe some people paying out the sick leave, others that are basically going to have it go away. They only have until then to use it, maybe till the end of the year. There's also some employers who are keeping it in place, so I've heard. So there's just, it's really business to business. There's not really a uniform answer on how this situation is being dealt with.
I want to step back from this specific issue for a moment. Missouri Republicans spent a lot of time and energy in 2024 talking about how the Missouri Constitution was too long and how groups should have a higher bar to amend it. But then they repeal a statutory initiative like this, which would likely drive groups to pursue more constitutional amendments. So are Missouri Republicans actually responsible for the problems that they're decrying perennially?
You know, I think you could make a case for it. I know when we were interviewing a lot of Republicans who were running for Secretary of State last year, one of them was Representative Adam Schwandren, who he himself had introduced legislation that would have actually added more protections for statute changes to more or less justify making it harder to amend the Constitution. And I think we could see situations like that. I know, like, when we posted basically an inquiry from people of like, how do you feel about this? There was a lot of people angry that they immediately changed it back. And so I think that does make the case for, well, you know, it's harder to change something in the Constitution once in there. So it's worth trying to get those extra signatures.
We've talked broadly before about the conundrum where Missouri voters approve progressive ballot initiatives and then elect Republican candidates. Should these voters, who you mentioned are very upset about this, really be surprised when lawmakers who fundamentally disagree with things like legal abortion and required paid sick leave respond with their legislative powers?
I think that there is kind of an element of expectation to be surprised, because obviously this happens, you know, not irregularly. We can count to, you know, Medicaid expansion and, you know, the debacle with Clean Missouri, Cleaner Missouri. But I think it was the speed at which this was done. So it was the session immediately after the vote. And I think that has angered a lot of people. And so I think, and also I think this issue of like minimum wage and sick paid sick leave, it's a simplified enough concept that voters understand what they voted for and what was taken away. So I don't know if they should be surprised for it about it, but I think clearly a lot of them are and they're mad about it.
If voters ultimately decide to reinstate the paid sick leave measure in the Constitution, do you think that could mark the end of the General Assembly trying to counteract ballot items?
No, is my simplified answer. I think making it harder for lawmakers to overturn statute changes would obviously complicate things, but I think there are still going to be attempts on it. And I also just think it's going to re-up Republicans trying to make it hard to amend the Constitution in addition. And so I don't think we're going to see the end of this.
Sarah Kellogg is St. Louis Public Radio State House and Politics reporter. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Today's episode was produced by Jason Rosenbaum.
Our audio engineer is Aaron Doerr. This podcast was mixed and edited by Aaron.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.